If you've had enough, or had near enough, sick and tired of that old man looking down on us, come together, as we think we got a plan. Save a teeny tiny traveling folk band.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Flat Nickel Podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Nawa. Today we have a really exciting interview with Billy Lyre. Billy is a Scottish acoustic punk artist who just so happened to be on tour in the US and needed a date filled. So he came and performed at the Thought Lot. And we were able to sit down and interview him before the show. And it was just a really great interview. I feel really happy with how it went. He was so friendly, and the people he was touring with were also super friendly. And it was just a really nice moment of connecting with an artist and hearing about their story and, you know, finding out who they are as a person, who they are as an artist, some of the exciting things that they've done. And it was just a really great, engaging conversation, and I really enjoyed talking with him. And I also really love his music, so if you have not heard of him, if you've not listened to his stuff, please, please, please go check out his music. We will, of course, leave a link to it. But he is right up my alley in terms of the style of music that I like listening to. So that was also really exciting to interview someone whose music, you know, spoke to me. That's always an exciting thing whenever you get to speak with somebody whose music means something to you. So yeah, this was a really exciting interview for me, and I'm really glad that we got the chance to do it before he headed back to Scotland. Hope you guys enjoy, and thanks for listening.
Lure back in who you are, what you do, where you're from, all the good basics, skim off the top.
Sure.
The cliff notes, if you will.
My name is Billy Lyre. I'm from Edinburgh in Scotland. I play acoustic guitar most of the time when I'm on tour, and it's kind of like punk influenced folk music, I suppose.
Is there, so when I was listening to your music, which this, your music is right up my alley.
Oh, thank you.
My dad was the one that facilitated the show. But when I listened to it, it was very much, like, I was happy that we got you here, because it's very much what I'm interested in. And I don't normally ask this question, because I know it's, like, the most infuriating question to be asked as an artist.
Right.
But as far as, like, the other bands or artists or songwriters that you've sort of gravitated towards, I guess almost molding your sound with, or... The basic question is who influences you, but I'm trying to make it sound more interesting because it's like the one of the most frustrating questions for musicians.
Yeah, it's quite a big question. I mean,
but are you the type of person where this is something we talk about, the music that you normally listen to, like you listen to in the car, is that the same sort of genre that your sound falls into, or are you listening to a whole wide variety of things?
Yeah, to be honest, I listen to all sorts of music. But when I first started playing music, I used to play like classical instruments. Once I started playing the guitar, that all went out the window, because I realized I could write songs and sing them and perform them at the same time. I listen to music of all genre. I suppose predominantly it's from a punk background or from like a songwriter background, I guess, but like I grew up with a wide range of influences from everything influences me, but books influenced me and films influenced me too, and you know.
Were there any particular artists that you remember being played a lot when you were growing up?
My dad got me into a lot of interesting stuff, like The Clash or The Jam or Tom Waits, Nick Cave. My dad's favorite band were The Doors, the Undertones from Ireland. And then I got into a lot of modern punk myself, and then I went backwards through like all their influences, and I just would go backwards and backwards and backwards until I found like what, you know, where that originally came from. But I listen to so much punk music when I'm on tour that sometimes it's nice to listen to music that's absolutely nothing like what I listen to. You know, what I hear
normal,
every night.
Yeah.
Because every night it's like punk bands or acoustic punk acts a lot of the time. So when I'm at home, I listen to quite a lot of like some of this classical music or like jazz or just anything that's different. Like, I like Bjork a lot and pop music. And
that's what I was going to ask. Is there anything sort of like surprising that you gravitate towards that maybe people wouldn't guess you're a fan of?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Not to make assumptions about you having met you 5 minutes ago. But, no. You know,
I guess people would be surprised, but I don't know what would be surprising, you know.
For me, it surprises me the most when just the amount of punk rock artists and musicians who, when you ask them about their favorite bands or who they listen to, it isn't just other punk rock musicians. Because it's such a specific genre.
Yeah.
I kind of assume that everybody just listens to each other within the genre. But there's a lot of people, I think, outside of it who, you know, the Foo Fighters are a good example of whenever Dave Grohl talks to me about... whenever he talks in an interview about who he's been listening to lately, I'm always surprised that it's not just whatever hard rock musicians are out in the day. Because, you know, he comes from a huge punk background.
Yeah.
But he, and every time I hear him talk about music, except for when he used to talk about the Pixies, he's always talking about like Fleetwood Mac, Heart, you know, old school classic rock bands that aren't necessarily who I would expect him from his background to be listening to.
Sure.
I feel like this whole thing is more your background than it is mine.
What, hard rock or punk?
Yeah, because I was in that scene very, very briefly and then got out. But this is something that you still go to shows, you still listen to, you're still involved in. So that's especially good that you came up for this interview, because I feel like you're going to be able to supplement a lot of the stuff that maybe I'm...
Have you seen that documentary, the Pixies one, Loud, Quiet, Loud?
Yeah, Loud, Quiet, Loud.
That's one of my favorite.
How many times have you seen them?
How many times have I seen them? Yeah. 6. And then it's going to come up on 8 this summer because they're going to be in Baltimore and Philadelphia again. So
nice.
If they're ever around, I have to go see them. They're the one band that I just have to drop everything for.
Cool.
Wasn't that...
Yeah, great band.
This is a weird thing to go off on, but wasn't that... Didn't you play a Pixies song for the last song on your last radio?
Yeah, my last song on my last radio show when I was a radio DJ was the Pixies. I did... Another Toe in the Ocean, one of their least popular songs. The most hipster way to go out.
So I guess I'm like, really just to get a feel for you, how many times have you toured in the United States?
This is my 4th time.
And you've toured, I saw also in Australia and New Zealand, which is very exciting because I love anybody that gets to go visit Australia and New Zealand, because I have so many friends there that I'll never get to meet.
You should go over.
I want to. I've never been on a plane.
Oh, you need to.
I'm such a child. I've never been on a plane.
Neither.
but I guess for you, what was the initial draw to touring in the United States? And is there like a specific benefit that you find other than maybe just a change of scenery?
Sure. Growing up... I've obviously watched a lot of American films and read a lot of American books and listened to a lot of American music, and then I've made more and more American friends, and so obviously I always had like an attraction, and I guess there's always an attraction of like bands that are based in the UK or Europe to come to go to America is like seen as like the big thing, you know, whereas like in America I've met a lot of American bands that think touring in Europe is like the big thing. It's like the opposite, the grass is always greener sort of thing. But the reason I first toured in America was because I got booked to play a festival in Gainesville, Florida, called Fest. And once I had that festival date, that was back in 2013, so 5 years ago, I booked a tour around that, basically. And each tour I've done in America has been touring around Fest. So I've played Fest 4 times, and each time has been basically up and down the East Coast around that, sometimes with a full band, but sometimes, most of the time, it's been solo or with other solo touring acts as well.
As far as...
The Fest is incredible. It's like one of the best festivals in the world. It's such a good time.
So you've played other festivals, other places.
Yeah, sure.
Because when I think, I guess one of the things that I wanted to get your perspective on is, for you or in your experiences, has festival culture been kind of universal? Has it differed, the different festivals you've played and the different countries you've played in? Because when I think of festival culture, when I first learned about festival culture, it was all the big festivals happening in England. And I was seeing all the, you know...
Glastonbury.
Yeah, all the cute young girls, you know, with their wellies on. And, you know, that's when I learned about music festivals. That's how I learned about music festivals. So has that kind of been, do you find it to be universal? Are they different? How are they different? Are the people different, or is it kind of all...
No, I mean, they're all different. Like, the sort of festival you're describing is not the sort of festival that I'd normally play, but mm-hmm. I have played festivals like that. There's a festival in Australia that I played, which is the reason that I went to Australia, where you basically play there for a week. It's on for 6 days, mm-hmm. and you can perform for, like, every day in those 6 days, and you get put in different tents every night. So that was a really incredible experience, and that's more of a festival, a bit like Glastonbury. Like, it's a big world music mm-hmm. festival. There's a lot of roots and blues and storytelling there, and they have, like, it's very family orientated, and they have like they have streets that go along in the festival, and they pay people to almost be like buskers, but they're paid to be there as well, so like everything is included. So there's these amazing like stilt walkers and puppet
is it the giant marionettes?
Yeah, there's stuff like that, yeah. And the clowns and everything, yeah. And it's all like part of it, and that festival is really incredible. But I mean most of the time I'm playing punk festivals. There's one in the UK called Rebellion Festival that I've played I think 9 or 10 times now, and it's that's probably the biggest of the kind of older punk mm-hmm. festivals that happens. It happens in Blackpool every year. That's different to Fest in America, because it happens in a big old like opera house, like a theatre, but they've got all these different stages, and everyone goes to this one space, and once you're in it, you just go to all the different, and there's like thousands of people there. But Fest is a thing that happens in Gainesville, mm-hmm. and like it basically takes over most of the bars and venues in Gainesville for 3 days and 2 days in Tampa, so it's like a 5 day thing, but it's it's different. It's like across the town.
How did that opportunity present itself? Was it something that you sought out? Was it something that was approached
Fest.
To you?
Yeah, I emailed Fest, and that's one of those things where people always told me that. I don't know. Bands always told me that Fest was a difficult thing to get onto, mm-hmm. and then I just thought, oh, you know, I was just sitting in my kitchen and I thought, I'd really like to play Fest. So I just emailed Fest, and then the organizer got back to me within an hour and said, that would be great. And, you know.
Do you...
So I said, yes! And I did it.
This is a great opportunity.
And I told my friends to contact them as well.
We talk a lot about festival culture. And I feel like each person we talk to has a very different perspective on whether or not they enjoy playing festivals and going to festivals. Is there a particular benefit you see in playing festivals as far as getting your music out to a wider audience? Do you feel at all as if you sort of lose the intimacy of maybe some of the smaller shows you play while you're on tour? Is there sort of a pro and con balance to that?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, it's a different thing because you're sometimes playing on bigger stages to bigger amounts of people. But those people often will then be the ones that, you know, continue to, you know, they get excited at the time because it's a cool opportunity for people who maybe wouldn't have come to see you play a local show, but they will go to a festival, mm-hmm. and then they're invested in the festival and they want to come and check out what's happening. So like, I don't mean to keep talking about Woodford, but Woodford, the festival in Australia, like, most people there, you know, certainly that were watching me wouldn't necessarily have gone to mm-hmm. see a punk musician playing yeah. at a bar, but they'll go and see the punk musician that's playing at the festival because they'll see it in the booklet and think, mm-hmm. oh, this sounds interesting. And, you know, some of them will like it and some of them will hate it, but some of them stick around. And...
The kind of shows you play outside of festivals,
yeah.
Are you playing a lot of, you know, basement shows? Are you playing a lot of bars, like you said?
Oh, it's a mixture. It's like either... like venues or like bars with a separate room. Mm. I've played house shows. I've played on boats. I've played like...
On boats?
I've played people's kitchens. I've played like...
Wait, but I want to know why you were on a boat.
I've played like 3 boats in my life. Like there's a festival called Rotterdam Riot that happens in the Netherlands, and everyone there plays on a boat. They have bands playing upstairs and downstairs, and I played on a boat that went around Sydney Harbour. They had a festival there called Schooner Later that goes around... Sydney Harbour, and they had bands playing on the main level, and then they had acoustic acts playing upstairs through a PA. And while I was playing, like, the speakers kept almost falling into the sea as we went past like Sydney Opera House, and people had to keep like running and grabbing speakers and stuff and them falling into the water.
That is not something I would have ever thought. Like, hey, let's put a bunch of musicians on a boat.
Yeah, it's become like a more common thing. I think it's partly because of this, like, this bigger festivals are starting to happen on, like, cruises. Have you seen this stuff?
Yes, yeah. So
Kiss have a cruise, I think, mm-hmm. and there's, like, old rock ones, and there's punk ones, and there's ska ones. So then, like, basically some of my friends are starting to think, like, it would be funny to put, you know, smaller amounts of people and have more of, like, an independent punk show on a boat sort of thing. Like, if we're going to book a bar, why not book a boat instead? It's become a thing. There's a festival based on it now called the Hamburg Booze Cruise Festival, which I played in Germany this year, where they take over a lot of bars in the town, and they also put a lot of punks on a boat, and everyone just drinks beer and eats pizza and watches bands and kind of gets a bit seasick.
We found the next Flat Nickel project.
Yeah, dude.
You know, who festival needs, on a boat.
We need to find some water. Shippensburg's pretty landlocked.
Yeah, where's the nearest water?
Delaware? Rehoboth? Maybe?
Ocean-wise? Yeah, but we don't have to do it on an ocean. Well, we can go to a river.
Or a lake? Erie?
Yeah.
There's a swimming pool at the hotel I'm staying at. I mean, you could...
You know, I mean...
Just get a bunch of inflatable ducks.
it kind of is, though, like, what you're going along with the thought of, well, if we can fill a bar, why not fill a boat?
Yeah.
I mean...
And make it something different and interesting.
Festivals manage to book hotels all the time, so why not have a band play at that hotel?
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those things of it sounds crazy until you do it, you know? And then it just becomes the new norm.
Did you ever meet Emily Barnes? Yeah. We had an evening where... Are you at the Marriott?
Yeah,
that's where the pool is. So yeah, we sat in the lobby of the Marriott and just recorded her playing music mm-hmm. for a couple hours and just sat there and, you know, I don't know. It's
a nice hotel.
It's a nice hotel.
I've been very friendly.
It's Shippensburg's newest hotel.
Oh, is it?
As a part of Shippensburg University, please pay attention to me. I'll mention that at dinner.
Might have a casino coming here soon, too.
Oh, really?
On Shippensburg?
Parks filed for a mini casino license.
Tiny game thing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure. I want to do a boat show now.
Sure.
They're really fun.
Yeah. This seems like something that is the next Flat Nickel project.
Can I, real quick? If I could just interject with, because we're talking about you being international with, you know, where you live, and then America, Australia, and New Zealand, sure. right? And so, you know, what's the kind of the difference from punk scene from place to place?
That was my next question.
Oh, it was the next question? I'm so sorry for stealing that. My bad. It's just because, like, so when we talk about, like, the American punk scene, which is a lot of, you know, house shows, basement shows, that kind of stuff, you know, the non-huge artists, the non-record label artists, it kind of is almost like every show is a music festival of... You know, these people try and book like 5 or 6 bands to play in their basement, play in their backyard or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you make a day of it. It's basically a 1 day long music festival. So like, you know, what has your experience been varying from country to country playing in different punk scenes?
My first American tour was like that. Like I played a lot of people's houses. There was like house shows, basement shows, like backyard shows, like I say. But each tour, the three other tours I've done since then have been more in venues and bars and stuff, which has made it a bit more financially viable, mm-hmm. and it's made it a bit easier. But the first time it was, I mean, it was an absolute riot, but it was, you know, quite emotionally exhausting. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely a culture of that DIY, doing stuff in basements and doing stuff in crazy situations in America that doesn't happen in other countries, like in touring in mainland Europe, in like Germany and the Netherlands and Belgium and Spain and Portugal, you know, all those countries, a lot of that stuff, you're playing in squats or you're playing in squats that have been there for so long that they're now no longer squats and people actually live there. And a lot of the time it's funded by the local government, like it's they get arts grants to support theater groups to go there. Also punk musicians, you know, metal band, you know, like anything that's not ordinary, like the art and the culture gets supported there. In the UK, I mostly play venues or you know, bars with another room, because it's very difficult to put on house shows in the UK, because the minute you put on a house show, someone will phone the police and then it's just gets shut down straight away. Mm-hmm. Which did happen to me the first time I toured in the States as well. When I played in Richmond, Virginia, the cops turned out.
That's something that occasionally happens. We have a what is essentially a DIY punk basement venue here.
In Shippensburg?
Yeah, in Shippensburg.
Oh, right.
That is just somebody's basement, and he puts on, Ian puts on shows, and, you know, we'll get touring bands in, and that's just their little, you know, their little project that they do. Mm-hmm. And I know several times they've had the cops called on them, and the cops have come shut down shows even before ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's one of those things that I feel like doesn't happen for other genres or other, well, maybe rap. Rap
gets shut down. It's kind of one of those things of, like, the genres and the worlds of punk, folk, and Americana are really all starting to blend together in the modern age. You know, certain, like, Americana and folk groups might, like, lean towards country, like mm-hmm. we've had before. Mm-hmm. But then if they don't, they tend to lean towards punk music. Like, it really is kind of, it's not like...
Such as,
well, I mean, you described yourself as a punk folk artist, right?
Oh, sure. Okay.
And then you've also got, like, Brett Newsky, who I'm a really big fan of, and he describes himself as Americana punk. And so, like, it's one of those things of you kind of get both those vibes. And it is really interesting, I think, in the modern age to see the blending of these three cultures all really come together more than any other genre that I can think of.
I think also the punk scene, more than any other genre, has access to these sort of DIY makeshift venues, at least here in the States. Every band that I know that is a punk band, that's what they're playing. They're not playing venues.
Yeah.
They're playing basements. They're playing community centers that turn into clubs at night. It's,
but the reason that, like, originally happened, I think, is because they wouldn't get booked in the bars or the mm-hmm. venues.
When so it was like, a counterculture.
We'll do it ourselves.
But, yeah, mm-hmm. just...
But that's made it really, like, that's the most amazing thing about the punk scene is that the punk scene is like, it has its faults, obviously, like mm-hmm. everything has its flaws, but it's trying to be an inclusive thing. Like, anyone can be a part of it.
Everyone's welcome
in theory. And yeah. And also, let's do whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And like, so many so many friends of mine in Scotland that play in bands that aren't kind of in that DIY punk scene, like, they don't know how to go on tour. They don't know how to, they're like, who's going to put my record out? Whereas I'm like, put your record out.
Do it yourself.
Yeah. Get on tour. Book your own tour. I book most of my own tours.
Yeah. So when you're searching for venues and just for our market, for the US in particular,
sure.
How are you finding venues? Like, are there any particular resources that you're using? Is it sort of just, what's your booking method for finding places to play?
It's just a bit of everything, really. It's just, it's something that I didn't know I didn't know how to do it when I first started. And it's just a matter of really just the more you do it, then the more you realize that you can do it. It's just one of those things that it's kind of like, I couldn't teach it to somebody because it's really just, it's more about like making connections, basically. Mm-hmm. And the more I've toured, the more I've met other people I've met other people through, and then, I've just kept going. Like, if you don't stop, and it just snowballs to a point where you can, I don't know. I don't book all my own tours, but I do predominantly. Am I answering your question?
Sure. Yeah, no, you're totally fine. I guess one of the things that we talk about, our last time Pocket Vinyl was in town, we didn't get to interview them, but we discussed with them. They are, he does very theatrical piano music and sings, and she paints a live original painting in 90 minutes, and that's their act, and they tour across the country.
Yeah.
And they did an awesome documentary about it.
Mm-hmm.
But we talked about websites and resources, things like, not Bands in Town, Indie on the Move, and how there is this website where it's like Airbnb, but exclusively for musicians.
Oh.
Where you have to like meet a certain amount of requisites as a host, it has to be like a private space, and you have to have a bathroom and things like that, to sort of put out, you've a place to stay that isn't, there are scenes in the movie where they're like staying in the back storage room at venues with sleeping bags.
Right.
Are there any like resources like that you've used, any sort of social, for lack of a better term, like social media technology that has sort of helped you facilitate touring or places to stay or networking?
I mean, sure, I use social media like most people do, I guess, these days. Like, I use Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff, but I haven't really used like a specific like touring thing to do that. You know, I just when I first started, MySpace was a thing, so like I definitely met people through MySpace, and that was a thing that a lot of musicians used at the time. But it's really just like Facebook. There are Facebook groups. There's one in the UK, I think, and there's a few in America which are like DIY. Mm-hmm. I think there's some called like DIY spaces or DIY places to stay or things like this. Mm-hmm. But I've never really used that because sometimes you can end up in some pretty
weird situations.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the most fun, but sometimes you don't want to do that all the time. So I guess the more I've toured, the more friends I've made or the more connections I've made. So therefore, I kind of don't need to put myself in that position anymore, you know?
Yeah. As far as the time that you have between shows or, you know, days off or travel days, is there anything in particular that you like to do? Anything that you, you know, do you try to stop and see some of the sights along the way? Do you...
Oh, yeah.
You know, are you a, you know, checking out every small town diner type thing, you know, bowling alleys?
Sure.
Is there any like specific day off things that you sort of like to adventure?
Well, I don't really take days off. And normally it's like tour into tour into tour. Mm-hmm. Like it's most of these tours just go into the back of each other. But when I do get some time, on a day, if there's like a short drive, I'll try and definitely at least check out a few things. Like this tour, because we've been touring around Halloween,
mm-hmm.
We've been trying to do as much like spooky stuff as possible. So like in Salem, we went to Salem and we tried to check out like a haunted house, and we had a day off in New Orleans, so we went to like a voodoo museum, and we went to a place in West Virginia that was called the Archive of the Afterlife, where there's a guy that runs it who basically collects stuff from serial killers and like graves stones and all this stuff.
There was
like
Virginia.
Baby caskets and I can't remember. It was like a really small town, but there's a lot of weird stuff in there. And he says like he speaks to serial killers who are dead and stuff. Like he's got a YouTube channel.
That sounds right up my alley.
It was really funny.
That
no, it's good. It's got some really interesting stuff in it.
If I ever
Archive of the Afterlife, it's
yeah.
Called.
If I can ever convince myself to go back to West Virginia,
that's the only time I've been there. But
I used to live there.
Oh
so,
yeah.
Yeah. I guess, so I mentioned earlier that this is kind of our way of collecting sort of the ultimate guidebook for touring musicians.
Sure.
Is there anything that you've learned along the way that you would want to pass on to people who are maybe just starting out touring? Any just advice, like metamucil?
I think the best advice would be to, you know, go to as many, like if you're into a particular genre of music, go to as many of those shows as possible. And really, like, also, you know, if there's not stuff happening in the town that you're in, start making it happen. Mm-hmm. And you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to say things to people that aren't right, and you're going to fall out with people, and people are going to tell you that you're an idiot. And then you just got to keep learning from those mistakes and adapting the way that you behave. And, you know, like, just learning, just mm-hmm. Taking everything in. Like, I started putting on shows in Edinburgh a long time ago. I just, you know, I started to book myself into places, because then I realized like no one else was going to book me, because why would they? Because I hadn't recorded anything and I, you know, wasn't playing particularly well. But then you book yourself, and then I started booking acts, you know, like reaching out to people who were on tour and seeing they had a day off and being like, why don't you come and play in Edinburgh, or why don't you come and play here? And then I could book myself on as a support, and then, you know, that's kind of how things start. And then if you start booking things and meeting people, like, you're only just going to meet more people and make more friends. Like, it doesn't have to be as cold and calculated as, like, you know, like that, you know, like,
the way that sometimes the business side of the industry can be very just there can be more personal.
I steer aspects. As clear, you know, as far away from that stuff as possible. Like, I think it's for me it's about relationships and friends and touring and traveling.
That's really interesting, because one of the things that we talk about, or like we sort of created, is this like Flatnickel family,
right?
Of we sort of have like these little seed pods all over the country of people that whenever we're traveling we can call up and say, you know, do you want to, you know, just go get dinner, we're in your hometown, we want to see where you're playing, you know, where you normally play, or we can hook up other bands. If there's a band that's playing in a city where we know somebody else, we can say, hey, do you have any places for these people to play.
Yeah.
And I guess sort of our business has been this very personal,
mm-hmm.
you know, let us help you. We're doing this because we care about art and music, and we want to help grow and develop these artists.
Sure.
And I feel like the business side of the industry is, you know, so much on profit and yeah. the smartest way to market something, and less about sort of the interconnection and the relationships that develop from this industry, which is sort of the fun of it, is,
yeah.
you know, the way that music is such a personal thing, and to interact with people on a personal level through this industry should be celebrated.
Yeah, I think so.
I had one more thing. Oh, so this was something I wanted to ask you about. I want to know the story behind it, because I was looking at your website and your little about thing.
Oh, right.
And about you co-writing, co-directing, and starring in a play at Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know how that happened. I want to know what the play was about. I want to know all of this. Do you have a background in theater? Like, I want to know that whole situation.
I definitely don't have a background in theater. I did drama at high school, but I dropped out of high school when I was 16 when I wanted to start playing music, and I definitely didn't, you know, I always had an idea that I wanted to do acting. I think every musician wants to be an actor, and every actor wants to be a musician, and there's this weird like push and pull, and then often they kind of switch careers in later life, and then they go back to their own, and sometimes they're good at doing the other thing and sometimes they're not. But I did a tiny bit of acting. I was in like a film in Newcastle, actually, like which is like a teen movie, which is like, I played like a film about teenage girls like taking drugs for the first time, drinking for the first time, and then getting into like relationships with people. So I was like an older character that was a musician who ended up being like a romantic interest of one of those characters. This is when I was a bit younger as well, but that was the only like, you know, dabbling in that sort of stuff that I'd done. But then I was touring with a friend of mine from New Zealand who lives in Berlin, called Freddie Fudpucker. And we toured together a lot the last few years, and I guess we both talked about how we'd like to do something that completely different, which is really quite like a lot of people who put on shows at Edinburgh Festival, like most of them have experience in doing this, or they're like acting in plays that other people have written, or a lot of people are just doing stand-up comedy, or musicians are playing music as part of the festival. But we decided to go completely in the deep end and just try and write a play that we were both going to act in, having never done anything like that before. So I was living in Germany at the time, like I was living in Berlin, so me and Freddie Fudpucker, we drank a lot of coffee, or we drank a lot of Fritz Cola, which is like a highly caffeinated sugary drink, and we just sat there with two laptops, like one across from each other, and we wrote out this play, and we'd basically decide how each scene was going to go, and then, well, we'd like have a rough idea, and then we'd both sit there and type something, and then compare the, you know, basically read the parts that we'd written to each other of each particular scene. And because we'd spent so much time touring together, playing music together, hanging out together on long drives and long distances, and, you know, like, we really were kind of to the point where we were sort of in each other's heads quite a lot of the time, so I could sort of tell what he was thinking. I still can. So that meant that when we wrote the play, actually, each time we read the parts to each other, we realized that we didn't need to change them, we just needed to combine them.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually just wrote the play like this. It was a play where it was about two characters stuck in an elevator, and you're unsure whether the elevator is like purgatory, or whether, you know, whether it's a real elevator, or basically me and him were on tour together in Hamburg in Germany, and we played a show and we stayed in a cheap hotel, and the next day we actually were staying in a cheaper hotel that didn't have a car park, so we were parked in a different hotel, so we went across town to this hotel, and Hamburg's a bit of a stressful place. I don't know if you've been there, but you're not been on a plane, but it's a bit of a stressful place, and it's a bit intense, and it's very expensive, and everyone's a bit stressed out, and anyway, so we went into this hotel. It was quite a fancy hotel to get to the car park, and we went in, and we had stuff that we were going to eat, and we had, like, you know, our bags with us and stuff, and then we got stuck in the elevator, and it was like hanging by a thread, and then I was like pressing the alarm button, but the person on the intercom was actually talking to us in German, but I thought it was a robot to begin with because they have such a robotic voice. So I ended up having this like weird interaction with a robot that actually turned out to be a person. Eventually managed to get out of the elevator, but we were in there for a good period of time where it went like up and down. I was like shaking, and eventually we got out. So both of us were having a really terrible time and opened up a window and thought we were going to throw up out of it, and then like got into the car, and then we were like in this underground car park, and Freddie was driving and he was like really stressed out, and there's a lot of like anxiety stuff going on there. So when we talked about writing a play, I thought, we didn't want to get anyone else involved, because who the hell else would want to do 28 shows? We did like 28 shows in 26 days or something. It was like a show every single night, and we were also flyering for our own show in costume every day, playing late night music shows, busking on the streets sometimes, like doing all sorts of stuff. So we knew that we couldn't really get anybody else involved, so we had to think about why would two people be in one situation. And then I thought about the lift, and I thought maybe we could have two characters stuck in an elevator. And then we thought about what would be interesting, and the interesting thing in drama obviously is always like opposites. Mm-hmm. So I was a politician who was about to be disgraced. Like the minute I left the elevator, my career was gonna, it's all over the news, but my career was about to be ruined. And I was a sleazy politician coming out of a hotel room. And the character that Freddie played was the bellhop. So like he works in the hotel and he hates his job, and he's like, he knows about the politician, but the politician doesn't know who he is. But then they obviously have to interact with each other, and the bellhop's got his own problems as well. And then it went into like nightmare dream sequence parts, and we had you know, we built our own props. Well, Freddie and my friend Emma actually like built this thing out of like a paint can and like a big stick, like a mop, mm-hmm. with no mop, but like a mop handle thing. And then we got like a effects pad, and like Freddie had to like, we like painted it black, and Freddie had to program the effects pad so it made like, you know, like each time you pressed a button it would make like a noise of the elevator. But we like had to record these voices, so like Freddie recorded them and then like manipulated them to make them sound like they were an elevator going wrong, because it obviously had to break. Mm-hmm. And then we wanted it to speak to us like the woman in the elevator had in Hamburg. So when you know, at first you think it's just an elevator voice, but then you start to realize it's another character. So there's a third character in the play. So we had like 12 different, there's only six pads, but then, or eight pads, I can't remember, I think maybe six. But then there was another button that could be pressed that would mean there was another six buttons, but that meant 12 sounds in total. So the voice of the elevator could only interact with us in 12 different ways, and we had to change it at one point in the play without making it look like we were just pressing buttons on a effects pad, and yeah, all that stuff.
Where are we at on time?
40 minutes.
No, it's totally good. I feel like this could be a very long episode.
Sorry.
No. It's interesting.
I think we do need to wrap up because the reservation was for 5, wasn't it?
5:30.
Okay, we're good then. Cool.
Do you have anything that you want to ask?
Well, I heard you bring up saying that you dropped out of school at 16. If you're comfortable talking about it, you know, like, what, I mean, you kind of said why, but what was the lead up and the decision, you know, what the process that made it happen, how'd that kind of,
and I guess also how did your family react? Because I think anytime
I figured that would come along.
Well, but anytime somebody does music full time, mm-hmm. especially in sort of the indie environment, mm-hmm. you know, telling your family like I'm not gonna be a lawyer, I'm going to play music and you do this incredibly strange, wonderful thing, mm-hmm. you know, there's always an interesting reaction.
If you didn't do music, would you be a lawyer?
No.
Would you be a sleazy politician?
No.
but yeah, bellhop. That would just be my question of, you know, like what life events were happening around that time that led up to the decision to drop out of high school?
So I went to a high school where I went to a primary school where I had a lot of friends, and I went to a high school where I really didn't like the school that I was at, and I really didn't like a lot of the teachers, and I don't know, I just, like, my parents, like, you know, they got me reading interesting books and listening to interesting music and watching interesting films and stuff when I was growing up, so when I went to school, I felt often, you know, patronized by these people who actually I thought were stupider than me, but I didn't know how to compute that at the time. In hindsight, I think it's just that, you know, it's very hard to be a teacher the UK has like weird, you know, they've got like weird curriculums that they stick to, and I just think like things like writing essays or doing exams and stuff really doesn't work for everyone. So of course, like, some school education can work for some people and they can go straight through school and they can go to college or university in the UK, but for some people they slip through the net and it just doesn't work for them. So for me, I was straight up like rebelling at the age of like 15 and did not want to go to class. So like I wasn't going to classes, so I was like skipping classes, wasn't handing in essays, wasn't doing things. There were classes that I was still doing well at, but that's only because I naturally was okay at them, like English or music or drama, but like stuff like maths, mm-hmm. science, I had like absolutely no interest in. So I was like failing really badly, like someone that, you know, really couldn't do them. And I don't know if my brain does work that way, because I just wouldn't let that stuff into my head. I was like, I have no interest in how this stuff works. I just want to read books and play music and stuff. So that's what I did. And at that point, both my parents were pretty supportive of the fact that I wanted to play music, because they could see that that is something that I'd grown up with. You know, I'd always like been musical since before I even started school. And my dad's a writer, so like, and my mom works in social work and sociology and feminism. So like, there are people that I was very lucky that they were like, you want to play music? You should play music. You want to quit school and get out there and earn some money and start playing music? Do it, you know. And they were like, if you want to go to college when you're older, or if you want to come back and go to university, that's okay too. Like, they also understood the limitations of schooling. And my dad left school when he was 16 too. So at first he was like, don't make the same mistakes as me, because he always wished he'd gone to university because of the friends that you make there and experiences that you have. But I've made a lot of friends and had a lot of experiences without going to university, or I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Oh no, it answers my question entirely, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
That is kind of something that I can speak on, is like, I was also told to go to school for the experience. My dad gave me those 4 years will be the best and quickest of your life.
Right.
And I think it did end up being true for me, but as I look around me, I don't think that's true for the majority of people.
Sure.
I really don't think people need to go to college to make friends and have experiences.
No.
Especially with the culture here in America nowadays. I feel like it's shifting so much more in the other direction of,
yeah,
school is such a process, and why would I want this, you know, six-figure bill after 4 years?
Yeah.
Because, you know, out here pretty much equals about five to six figures, you know, of money just to go and, you know, basically do the same thing. Like, especially my junior and senior year of college, I stopped going to the classes that I didn't care about.
Yeah.
And in college, you can afford to do it more now, because, you know, you don't have, instead of in high school where you have something due every day, I don't have something due for 3 weeks. So I can skip 2 weeks worth of classes and then go to that last week and still pass.
But yeah.
You know, I think I kind of wish that I feel like that whole phrase of, you know, you got to go to college and get the experience and make your friends that way.
Yeah.
It's more of a, like, a fallacy at this point. It's more of, that might have been true at one point, but it feels as though the culture shifted away from that now.
So, yeah, I think so.
I left school at 15.
All right.
But I finished my certificate degree. I got my diploma online. But I had health issues, and so I was removed. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a really great experience for me, because I was able to get my start in my industry at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this for 5 years, and I feel like I have much more enjoyed the experiences that I've had being in the music industry, mm-hmm. at a young age, and working with musicians and touring and making music videos and traveling, than I would have ever been happy had I stayed in school.
Yeah.
And it's something that, like, I kind of regret, because I didn't do very well through online curriculum. Like, I had a very low GPA. But I think that the experiences that I gained by leaving are far outweigh,
yeah,
any other option. You know, yeah. I didn't go to university, though I've considered it several times, but I would much rather do what I do now than sort of be tied down to And I don't want to recommend to any young people listening, drop out of school unless you really want to. I don't want to be the reason you do. But I think it was a beneficial way to experience the world versus being stuck in a classroom.
Yeah. It works for some people, but...
Yeah. And you know, because great people will go on to be doctors and lawyers, but, you know, you can do so many things and not go get a degree and not be 50K in debt after 4 years.
Mm. So. Yeah.
Want to wrap?
I think that's good, especially because it's starting to...
Glitch?
Yeah, but that's not unusual.
Yeah.
All right, that does it for another episode of the Flat Nickel Podcast. A couple of things you can do to help us out. Please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Subscribe to us wherever you might be listening, be it iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, and share the podcast with a friend. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Flat Nickel Podcast, and be sure to tune in next Wednesday at 11 a.m. for a brand new episode.